Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Folklore, which is one of the New Books Network's wide range of podcast channels. I'm Rachel Hopkin. I'm one of the hosts of this channel, and today we'll be hearing from the eminent folklorist James P. Leary about his book Folk Songs of Another America, Field Recordings from the Upper Midwest, 1937 to 1946. Now, this work was originally published as a hardback and came with five CDs. Now it's just come out as a paperback, and instead of CDs, online access to the music it describes, of which there's a wonderful selection, many, many tracks, comes courtesy of the website of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Library. And there'll be a link for that online with the blog that accompanies this podcast. Anyway, James P. Leary, whom hereafter I'll call Jim, welcome to the New Books in Folklore podcast.
Thanks, Rachel. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'll start with my traditional question, which is to help orientate those listeners who don't have a background in folklore studies. Can I first ask you to tell us what you understand folklore to be, or maybe just what you understand a folk song to be, given the subject of the book?
Sure. I think of folklore as the traditional expressive practices of people within different cultural groups and contexts. And of course, that gets a little murky in complicated society. The original idea, I think, was based on people living in isolated old-time peasant societies. But certainly in the United States, that's never really happened. And so you had indigenous people and you had people coming from maybe many European peasant and or working class backgrounds. But once over here in what became the United States, they're all kind of fellow workers in rural areas or in factories or one thing or another. And so when they get together, they have different songs that they know in common, and some of them are changing as a result of new people busting up against one another. And then at the same time, in complex societies, you have popular music that's going on, and there's always a relationship between so-called popular music and kind of folk music or grassroots music. Sometimes stuff moves in one direction or in the other. And so I guess as a folklorist, what I'm interested in is what people in kind of local grassroots communities are singing and playing and how they're making music that has to do with who they are and where they've come from and where they're living during the period when they're all, you know, singing and being around one another. So it's not a pious, restrictive kind of approach to what gets called a folk song. It's more a look at kind of local vernaculars that are active.
So tell us a little bit about how you came to be a folklorist, a little bit about your career trajectory, because it's very much bound up with this book, I think.
Well, I grew up in a small farming and logging town in northwestern Wisconsin, and that's in kind of the upper Midwest of the United States. I was born in 1950, and when I was growing up, there were a lot of people who whose lives and cultures and the way they talked, the food they ate, and customs they practiced were tied with the various groups that happened to congregate in that area. So there were Ojibwe or Chippewa Indians and some people who were Métis or often French Indian, so-called mixed blood people. There were a lot of people who themselves or their parents or in some cases grandparents came from different parts of Europe. And there were a lot of Norwegians in my hometown, but there also were Swedes and some Danes, a few Finns. There were Lithuanians. There were people, various Slavic people, especially Czechs and Polish people. There were Southern Italians. There were lots and lots of Germans. There were people of English and Irish and Welsh background. There were a few people of Belgian ancestry and quite a few French Canadians who'd come down from Canada. So that's the milieu that I grew up in. And hanging out with my friends or being on the street or hanging out when my parents got together with people or kind of went around through the area, I would hear languages other than English spoken or people who clearly hadn't spoken English as their first language. I would encounter Norwegian lutefisk and, Polish pierogies and Czech knedlíky or potato dumplings and, you know, all these interesting foods. And then there was a lot of music. Some you could hear sneaking along with, by the time I was a teenager, you could hear in taverns, but over the radio, there was Swiss music and Scandinavian music and Czech music and Polish music, a lot of it mixed up with country Western music and jazz and so forth. So that's kind of where I grew up. Now, I didn't really know that there was a field of folklore studies. My parents were journalists, and so they were observers of the area around them and had a kind of a keen understanding of some of the cultural complications that they witnessed and participated in and experienced. But I didn't really know you could kind of study folklore or folk music. But when I was growing up, I developed a real interest in different kinds of musical traditions. And luckily, when I was an undergraduate in college, at the end of my sophomore year, I had some friends at that time, some of them older, who knew of my interests and actually knew you could also study folklore. And so I was lucky then to kind of find the path that I'd, the sort of official path, I suppose, or the pathway to work that intersected with the pathway of my own interests as a person coming from where I came from.
Tell us now about this book, which I think is the product of a lifetime's work hitherto up till now.
Well, in my hometown, there was a very remarkable place called the Buckhorn Tavern and Cafe. And it was run by a guy named Otto Rindlisbacher and a couple of his brothers. And Otto was the son of Swiss immigrants. His mother's family and his grandfather were people who played a lot of traditional Swiss music. And as a young man, Otto learned how to play the Schweizer hand orgel, this little Swiss button accordion. He was also an excellent fiddler. And there were Swiss in my hometown who had been recruited by local farmers as cheesemakers. So there was a little bit of a Swiss music scene. But Otto also, as a young man to make a living, he worked in lumber camps, and he worked in sawmills and mills in Rice Lake. And in those camps, the work was done in the winter when they could move around the big timber. But on Saturday nights and Sundays, people had time for some recreation. And in the camps, there were Ojibwe Indians, and you know, there were these, you know, Czechs and Germans and Norwegians and Swedes and Swiss and Irish and all of these other groups that I, French Canadians that I'd mentioned before. And so there were a lot of tunes that were played, and Otto learned a lot of those different kinds of tunes, especially on fiddle. Also in the early 20th century, there was an immigrant Norwegian musician named Torstein Skarning, who was an accordion virtuoso, and he had made 78 RPM records in Norway before coming over. And then he toured all around Wisconsin and Minnesota into the Dakotas, and he recruited Otto and eventually Otto's wife to back him up, but also as part of a kind of a variety show, a ethnic vaudeville show in the upper Midwest. Skarning would do kind of Norwegian and classical numbers on his accordion, and Otto would play Swiss numbers along with his wife, and then they would play for a dance. So he was playing that stuff. In the 1920s, Otto's wife, Iva, was a skilled guitar player, and Hawaiian music was a big deal. So she learned how to play a Hawaiian lap steel guitar. And then in the mid-20s, Henry Ford, who was worried about the corruption of American civilization by a conspiracy of blacks and Jews who were foisting jazz upon teenagers and so forth, Henry Ford sponsors these old-time fiddle contests through his dealerships, and they didn't necessarily buy into the ideology or even know about it, but Otto was involved in these old-time fiddle contests in the mid-1920s as well. So he epitomized a lot of the musical mixing and ferment and variety of my home region. And in his tavern, he had festooned along the wall of the back bar were what he called the world's largest collection of odd lumber camp musical instruments. And some of these were the instruments, conventional ones like fiddle and so forth, that I described. But he also had cigar box fiddles and guitars made out of plank, and a so-called Viking cello, which was a pitchfork with a single string that was played with a cello bow and a slide, and also a kind of a tin trumpet that was used as a dinner call in lumber camps, and you know, a number of other instruments. And so when I was a kid, I was kind of thrilled to go in there. And I learned from my dad and his sister that Otto had made recordings for the Library of Congress. And so when I was, I don't know, somewhere in my mid-teens at our local public library, I found an LP recording called Folk Music from Wisconsin, issued by the Library of Congress. And in there were a number of fiddle tunes that were recorded by Otto Rindlisbacher. And, you know, I thought they were pretty great as a teenager. And then later on, when I had discovered that there was a field of folklore studies, and I ended up applying to graduate school, I got a master's at North Carolina in folklore, and then I went on to Indiana University and got my PhD in 77. In the course of doing that, I learned a lot more about the archive of American folk song at the Library of Congress and who was involved with it, and that there might be additional recordings. And little by little, I discovered that Otto had been recorded by three different folklorists, by Sidney Robertson in 1937, by Alan Lomax in 1938, and by Helene Stratman Thomas in the 1940s. And between them, they had recorded, those three folklorists had recorded 2,000 songs and tunes in 25 different languages from diverse people in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. In the mid-70s, you know, I was able to visit the Library of Congress because I was working that summer for the Smithsonian Institution's Festival of American Folklife, and I poked around some more. And then in the next decade, I did a lot of field recording in northern Wisconsin and all throughout Wisconsin, as well as in Michigan and Minnesota, producing LPs and cassettes and working on radio programs and for films and one thing or another. And as I did that, I began to meet a number of musicians who had been recorded for the Library of Congress back in the 30s and 40s, or their parents had been recorded, or they were present at the recordings, or they were from communities where recordings had been done and knew about them. So after a while, I started to produce little radio programs involving some of those people who, in one way or another, had been involved with the Library of Congress recordings in the region. And I began to imagine doing, you know, some kind of larger production. And I got in touch with the Association for Cultural Equity, or maybe they got in touch with me, I can't quite remember. And initially, I had thought about doing one CD focusing on Alan Lomax's recordings in Michigan in 1938. And they encouraged me to think bigger. And so, like a fool, I began to think about doing something much, you know, much bigger that would look at these three folklorists who did work in the region and try to find a way of representing all of their work within a single kind of, you know, multimedia production.
And this is what we have now, which is quite incredible. So, of course, in the original hardback edition, it came with five CDs, and now these tracks are all online, and anyone can access them through the University of Wisconsin-Madison Library's website. You've divided the book up largely according to the collectors, right?
Yes, I thought that might be the best way to do it, rather than to do it by, you know, genre or theme or ethnic group. Although within each collector's work, you know, I did subdivide things by cultural group, but it seemed to be the best way to kind of convey the chronological story. And the first person who recorded in the area, her name was Sidney Robertson at the time. She was born Sidney Hawkins, and she has a conventionally a man's name. It's spelled like the male spelling of Sidney. I think her parents wanted a boy. But she grew up in a well-to-do family in the greater San Francisco area. She was inclined toward music and was educated some at the Sorbonne, and then later in the late 20s and early 1930s, she was at Berkeley, and she became very interested in American kind of folk or roots music. A former Berkeley professor, Charles Seeger, the father of Pete Seeger, and Charles Seeger was, of course, one of the founders of ethnomusicology as a field, had taught for a while at Berkeley, and was sort of pioneering, I suppose, the worth of folk music for understanding the people, the common people of a particular area. So that became a strong interest of hers. And during the economic depression of the late 20s and early 1930s, she became rather disgusted with her privileged state. She was teaching at a kind of a prep school in the San Francisco area. And so she went to New York City to work in a settlement school for the poor and working class children of new immigrants or rural people who had come to the city. And during that period, Charles Seeger was who also taught at the New School for Social Research in New York City, was hired by the Franklin Roosevelt administration as part of their Depression era projects. He was in the resettlement administration, which also became known as the Farm Security Administration, and he was in the Special Skills Division. And his particular orientation was to kind of buoy up the spirits of people who were down and out in the hinterlands by calling attention from the august vantage of Washington to their own music, and also to encourage them to make and share that music as a way to kind of keep their spirits up. So Sidney Robertson soon after was hired, and she worked in a number of places. But in 1937, she was in Wisconsin, also doing work in Minnesota, and began to discover not just what she was accustomed to, and that is people of Anglo-American background playing banjos and fiddles and so forth, but what she also found were Serbs playing tamburica music, and she found Finns playing the kantele, and she found Norwegians playing selmodican, and she found French-Canadian performers, and she even found a Scots Gaelic singer from the Isle of Lewis singing those songs that he'd learned there in the Loish dialect. And so she made all of these kind of wild discoveries and was very excited about it. And in early 1938, she realized she had an opportunity to return to Northern California to do a similar recording project. And so she went back there and eventually did a very cool project that, as we speak, Kathy Kirst of the Library of Congress is working with Dust to Digital to put out a wonderful reissue sampling some of that recording. But Sidney Robertson wrote to Alan Lomax, who was then the assistant in charge of the Archive of American Folk Music at the Library of Congress, and said, you must come to Wisconsin. And Lomax, you may know, is part of a kind of a dynasty of American folklorists who pioneered the popular understanding of American folk song. His father, John, was from what he called himself the upper crust of poor white trash in Texas, went to University of Texas, grew up hearing cowboy songs as a young man, had a lot of entrepreneurial savvy, and in 1910 published a book called Cowboy Songs and Other Frontier Ballads that he got former President Theodore Roosevelt to write the introduction for, comparing these songs to the stirring ballads of the Scottish, Northumberland border country. And in the early 1930s, John Lomax was making recordings for the Library of Congress and took his teenage son, Alan, with him on a famous trip through the South in 1933, where, for example, they recorded Leadbelly for the first time. Alan Lomax was also famous for making the first recordings of Muddy Waters or McKinley Morganfield when he was a tractor driver in Mississippi on Stovall's plantation. And he did a lot of important early recordings of Woody Guthrie as well as recording in Haiti. Very few people know or knew until recently that he did recording in Michigan and a little bit in Wisconsin. So in 1938, he had this very ambitious idea that he was going to, in 3 months, sweep all the way through Michigan, Wisconsin and Minnesota, recording all the folk music of all the diverse peoples there. And he pretty much got hung up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, this kind of remote mining and logging area, where he spent a lot of time with Finns and French Canadians and had to write back to the Library of Congress to get more money because, as he wrote, I'm not wastreling, but one cannot make recordings here without beer.
Without what? Sorry, I didn't catch that.
Without beer. Without beer. So there he was with this, giant portable disc-making cutting machine and a big bulky microphone and blank discs and extra supply of needles. And then he'd record discs and have to label what they were while driving around in his car from various singing beer parties, one to another. But he recorded an astonishing number of performances, about 1,000. Sidney Robertson had recorded maybe about 250 or so. And then Lomax had to return to Washington, D.C. for other tasks late in the fall of 38. And he wrote to the library or to the University of Wisconsin-Madison Music Department to see if anyone would take up the work. And there was a very spunky woman, Helene Stratman Thomas, who had a music degree. She was an instructor in music there, but she also had business training, and she was very well organized, and she was also a very capable driver, willing to drive at breakneck speed down narrow gravel country roads traversing the state of Wisconsin, which she did in the summers of 1940 and 41. And then there was a break during the war years because of shortages and restrictions on gasoline and tires. And then she went back and made some final recordings in 1946. So she recorded over 700 songs and tunes. And so what I did with the project was then to have the first CD reflect Sidney Robertson's recordings. The second one focuses on a group from my hometown that involves Otto Ringelsbacher that I talked about and some of the odd lumberjack musical instruments. And these recordings were made both by Lomax, who recorded Ringelsbacher and the Lumberjacks in 38, and Sidney Robertson, who had recorded them the year before in 37. Then there's a CD and accompanying notes with Lomax's Michigan recordings, plus one day recording a Chippewa or Ojibwe fiddler in northern Wisconsin. Then there are two CDs of Helene Stratman Thomas's work in Wisconsin. And as you mentioned, we issued all of those. We had to we had to make digital transfers of deteriorating discs. And once the transfers had been made, then we had to do cleanup of the sound. And in some cases, we had to do speed correction because some of these were made with shifting power sources. So they were a little slower or faster. So we had to make those adjustments, which meant I had to work in different ways to raise a lot of money to do that. And then initially, we were able then to raise some more money so we could package all of these discs with the book all in one package, but price it at a price that everyone could afford. We couldn't raise that money again for the packaging and production of the accompanying CD at the same cost. And so our solution was to put up everything online and just have it available free, with the book part being like the world's largest set of liner notes. And I should also mention that the project included a film. As if Alan Lomax wasn't kind of ambitious enough, by carrying around all this recording equipment, he also took with him a Technicolor movie camera. And he made silent film footage of a lot of people he recorded. Sadly, some of the film footage was stolen. We don't know why, but some of it was stolen from his car. But he brought the rest back, and Guha Shankar of the Library of Congress digitally restored the film. At first, I thought it was black and white because I'd only seen a video copy, but it was color. And he did not keep very good notes about who was in the film. So I had to use a lot of internal evidence to figure out who was in the film and where. And in some cases, I could rely on next of kin or other kinds of evidence. And then we had to try to match up tracks by performers with footage in the film. And we also used some still images. And we had some of Alan Lomax's field diaries. And I got the eminent country music scholar, Bill C. Malone, who happens to live nearby where I live now in Wisconsin, but Bill is originally from East Texas, and his dialect is at least somewhat similar to Alan Lomax's, who is a fellow East Texan. So I recorded Bill reading Alan Lomax's field notes and correspondence, and then kind of worked out a film treatment or sequencing with Guha. And I went out to the Library of Congress, and we did a rough cut of the film, and eventually Guha finished it up. So that was a DVD that came out with the original production, but now it too is available free on the University of Wisconsin Library's Folk Songs of Another America site.
Right. So this was a monumental undertaking. And although you sounded a bit sad that you hadn't been able to raise the money to put everything together into a new set, it's actually turned into a great advantage. We can all hear these tracks or see the film.
Absolutely. And the other thing I should mention is beyond the technical and fiscal challenges of this, the fact that the songs were in 25 different languages, and not only that, but many dialects thereof, and then sometimes complicated by mixed language or by esoteric occupational speech or jargon, made it a real challenge to get the lyrics and then to do translations. And but because we had the stuff in digital format, then I could send digital files to friends who knew Welsh or Lithuanian or Quebecois French or Ho-Chunk or some of these languages. And so that too was kind of a monumental challenge.
Right. I should say that the book was the winner of the Association for Recorded Sound Collections Award for Best Historical Research in Folk or World Music and a Grammy Award nominee for Best Liner Notes. And if you look at I got kind of tearful when I was looking at the reviews because there's just all those like stellar, you know, it's truly amazing, monumental, a stunning work of curation and scholarship. So comprehensively detailed and thoroughly vetted that it would be hard to see where one would have a complaint about this magnificent volume. It's just like people falling over themselves to praise it, which I'm not surprised about, but it's lovely that your work is getting this acclaim.
Well, it was such a thrill to read all of those. And as you say, I feel like I worked at it my entire life, you know, little by little. I'll never do anything like it again, but it was just, I felt like there are a couple of small mistakes in there that I was able to at least, I hope, address in the short introduction to the paperback edition. But for the most part, with a lot of help from a lot of amazing and generous and highly skilled people, you know, I think we nailed it. So it is a good feeling.
So we're going to have a little listen to a few of the pieces. Now, I'm going to tell the listeners this is not going to be high quality audio because what I'm doing is playing the tracks on one computer and recording them on another. But the listeners can access the tracks directly via the website that we've been talking about, where they'll hear how wonderfully they've been digitally remastered. So the first one we've chosen comes from the section of recordings by Sidney Robertson, who I must say I rather like. I'm just going to read a little bit of a letter that you featured an excerpt.
Oh, yeah.
She's sending a report to her Washington superiors, and she says, "This is a rough country. 3 saloons or taverns to every block on each side of the street. And at a small crossroads villages, there is usually a store, a gas station, 2 houses and 2 taverns. I went into 3 taverns on the main street in Rhinelander in the morning at Mr. Sorden's suggestion, looking for a miniature carved logging camp that some tavern keeper owned. And I swear I was a marked character the rest of the day. I've never been so stared at, nor so suggestively appraised anywhere in the world. Wherever I went, and by the toughest looking characters. I swear my Lower East Side gang couldn't touch them."
Yeah, you know, I was just in Rhinelander about 10 days ago, and I thought about that particular passage, and it's very much like my hometown, Rice Lake. And these were rough old logging towns, and if you were a single woman on the street, And then going into taverns that were hangouts for lumberjacks, people would kind of raise their eyebrows. But she was a very tough and spunky person, and in fact, she recorded some bawdy songs, and I just have tremendous admiration for her. Her nerve and her skill and her openness, her pluck.
Was she the one that recorded the alphabet song that you mentioned in the introduction, which is A is for R?
No, that was that's one of my favorites. No, that was Helene Stratman Thomas. Actually, it's kind of a funny thing. When Alan Lomax was recording, he recorded some raunchy songs, and there are plenty of them in this collection. Mm-hmm. There was one that was kind of like the holy grail of the lumber camp vulgar or bawdy song, The Red Light Saloon, about a whorehouse. And mm-hmm. he had heard about it, but had never been able to record a version. So he asked Helene Stratman Thomas specifically to hunt for this song, and she found people who knew it, but they didn't want to sing it for her. Fortunately, she had a student engineer that she worked with. He traveled. He was an engineering student who was also a music major. And so he ran the recording equipment. So on these occasions, she went out and waited in the car, and then they would sing, sing these songs, including, that Lumberjacks, the alphabet song. All in all, I mean, she ended up capturing three versions of the Red Light Saloon Alan Lomax hadn't gotten any. And I put two of them the song.
But we're not going to hear that at the moment, nor are we going to hear the alphabet song, which I was so enchanted by the sound of. We're going to hear something by John Matheson. This was recorded by Sidney Robertson on the 18th of September in 1937. And it's, I can't possibly say the word in the title in Gaelic, but it's
he'll sing it.
Road. So do you want to tell us a little bit about this?
It's a song. It's kind of a song about gathering various Scottish clans together. So it's kind of a battle song that John Matheson, who came from the Isle of Lewis to Duluth, Minnesota, sang.
Okay, here we go. In a moment, it just takes a second to load on my other computer. And a second more. So you say in the liner notes, this is similar to the tune of London Bridge is Falling Down. It certainly sounded very familiar to me by that.
Yeah. And one of the cool things about Matheson is there is currently in the Minneapolis, St. Paul greater area, a singer of Scots descent, Laura McKenzie, who sings in Gaelic. And she, I've worked with her some at different festivals, and I shared these recordings of Matheson. There were 13 tracks altogether. Four of them are on this Folk Songs of Another America. And she decided she wanted to do a new production with new recordings that she and other people made of all 13 songs. And she was able then to get in touch with Matheson's granddaughter. I had contact for that and made a really fantastic CD and has been doing concerts related to it. So one of the exciting things, and I guess one of the reasons why I've done this project, one of the many reasons, is to put the music of the Upper Midwest into circulation, right, in hopes, in part, not only that people would learn about it, but also some people would take this up instead of looking to other parts of the country or the world for inspiration. You know, they could find some things right here.
The next track we selected, so we had a look at one from each section. So the next section, which was about lumberjacks, you picked out Stearman's Valse.
Yeah, and this I chose this in part because it was made by someone I knew in the late 80s. I was making co-producing a radio series called Down Home Dairyland, and I interviewed Ray Calkins, who plays on this track. He was living in a little community, Chautauqua, near my hometown of Rice Lake, in a rest home. He was in his 90s, and he talked to me and recorded different songs and tunes. But this one is played on a homemade guitar, a lumber camp made guitar that he called the Paul Bunyan harp, after that kind of woods giant. And the tune that he's playing, he called it something like, I don't know, Paul Bunyan's Waltz or something like that. But it's a well-known Scandinavian tune called Stearman's Valse, Pilot's Waltz, like the pilot of a ocean-going vessel. And so you'll hear him play it on this kind of simple lumber camp instrument, and it's kind of an interesting instance of exchange across cultures and kind of renaming of songs that happened in the upper Midwest region.
Recorded at the National Folk Festival, I saw.
That's right. Yeah, partly as a result of Sidney Robertson's efforts in Wisconsin, but also through the efforts of Sarah Gertrude Knott, who founded in the early 30s this annual event called the National Folk Festival. Otto Rindlisbacher and the Wisconsin Lumberjacks, or he was asked to put together a troupe for the National Folk Festival that was happening in Chicago. And so it occurred there in 1937, and then the next year, the same group of Wisconsin Lumberjacks went out to Washington, D.C. To perform. And so Sidney recorded them in Chicago in 37, and then the following year, Alan Lomax recorded them in Washington.
Now, in the next section, the section devoted to recordings made by Alan Lomax, and the track that you chose from there was by Exilia Belair. Now, tell us a little bit about Exilia.
Well, Exilia and Mose Belair, they can actually be seen in the film that goes with this, sitting outdoors singing a duet, but they had a big house and a large family. They were very sociable. They were a French Canadian family, so that's where a lot of these recordings were made, and also through their contacts. In the late 80s, I knew about all these recordings made in this community of Berrigo, Michigan, and they had a little area called Frenchtown, and so I wrote to the local paper listing the names of a whole lot of people who were recorded to see if anyone remembered them, if there were descendants around. And I was able to go back to that community then and meet a lot of descendants, including a number of Mose and Exilia Belair's daughters who were present and, who experienced those recordings and could talk about them. So this song is a French Canadian song. It's well known in Canada, and it's one of those macaronic songs. And it's about a young woman and her misadventures going to market. But in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, there's a community called Marquette, and so she sings that I went to Marquette, and she's mixing French and English back and forth. So this is Exilia Belair.
Went to market à mon panier de semaine, bras. En ma way, j'ai rencontré la fille de l'avocat. Oh, I love you, un homme meilleur. Oh, I love you, un homme mais pas. I bought some apples, you picked not a pot. I bought a dozen, ou pas vous les faire. Oh, I love you, un homme meilleur. Oh, I love you, un homme mais pas. I bought some apples.
Wonderful stuff. And we're moving into the recordings of Helene Stratton,
yeah.
Thomas. We're going to cut straight to the last CD and hear a little bit of a Polish piece.
Matusz Moja, yeah. This is Bernice Barnack. And she and her husband were journalists in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, which is the largest rural Polish area in the United States. And they had quite a repertoire of traditional songs. And this is a song a young girl is asking her mother support to marry a handsome young fellow with curly hair.
Matusz moja, matusz, wydaj mnie, zajasia spodobały, mi się kółeczka upasa, oj dana. Oj dana, 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 oj dana.
So, of course, people, all our listeners should go straight to the website and find all of these. I think it's 187 tracks altogether. Is that right?
Yes. Once you get to the site, you can scroll down, and there, my daughter, who's an artist, made some beautiful woodcuts, kind of emulating 19th century broadsides for each of the CDs plus the film, and you could click on those to browse through all the tracks, or else you can search by a language or an ethnic group or something like that. But it's Folk Songs of Another America.
So you said a little bit earlier that one of your reasons for creating this project was because you wanted musicians today to know about this music and include it in their repertoire. I was curious to know why people haven't known so much. It seems to have been an underrepresented area in terms of coverage of its music, because we all know about the Appalachian folk music and the country music in the South and so on and so forth. But this place, this area is incredibly rich. Why is its richness not so well known, do you think?
I think there are a lot of reasons. I mean, one is, I suppose, maybe the success of the Lomaxes and all in popularizing music of Southerners and also of cowboys in the early 20th century, but also in American life, the Midwest, the upper Midwest, is sort of thought of as either this boring kind of place or an extension maybe of New England. But in the upper part, the fact that people came from so many different places and there were, you know, more Germans, for example, than anyone else, made this area in some ways seem, not part of the mainstream. There's been this suppression of so-called foreign life, of this denial of immigrant heritage and cultural pluralism and diversity in American life that unfortunately has been a kind of a continuous thread in the United States. So, you know, when people think of American folk music, most of the people I grew up, when they think of folk music, they've been trained to think of folk music as music that comes from other parts of the United States. And I remember interviewing an old fiddler who played Anglo-American, but also Norwegian and Czech tunes, and he'd been playing them. He was a third generation fiddler. He said, I've played a lot of different kinds of music, but I've never played folk music. And of course, by that he meant sort of the commercialized folk music of urban people playing music that they didn't grow up with, but that they've appropriated from field recordings or else, are singer-songwriters who are kind of making up their own stuff. So anyway, that contributes to it all.
Well, congratulations on this wonderful work. Are you working on anything at the moment, or are you taking a rest?
No, I'm always working on stuff. I'm working in part on getting a lot of these materials online, and we have a larger website called Local Centers Global Sounds, where we're putting up a lot of field and home recordings from the upper Midwest as a region, along with a lot of 78 RPM recordings that were issued for immigrant and ethnic groups in the United States in the 20s and early 30s. And then I've just produced a two CD set, or co-produced a two CD set and booklet called Alpine Dreaming, the Helvetia Record Story with Archaeophone Records, that has to do with a Swiss immigrant label established in Wisconsin in the early 1920s. And we found every 78 they put out, and it's coming out this month.
Oh, good heavens. Well, listen, thank you so much, Jim Leary. James P. Leary is your official author name. Yeah. And for taking part in this New Books in Folklore podcast, which is part of the New Books Network. And hope you have a lovely rest of your day.
Thanks so much, Rachel. It's been a treat.